Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2020. And I'm now here with John Bruce Leonard. And he's a man that I've wanted to speak to for quite some time, and it never really came up until now. So, John, welcome to Millennial.
Delighted to be here, Millennial Woes. Thanks so much for having me. And I've also wanted to speak to you for a long time, so this has worked out nicely then.
Excellent, excellent. Well, could you introduce yourself to the audience?
Certainly.
In case anyone hasn't heard of you.
So my name is John Bruce Leonard, and I'm a writer and an expatriate of the United States of America. I live in Italy at present, and I've settled in Italy is the better way of putting that. I have no intention of moving ever again. But anyway, I am the editor-in-chief of Arctos Media Limited, which is, I'm sure, you know, most of your public knows well enough what that is. Woes, but in any case, just as a very, very brief recap, it's a small publishing house dedicated to the publication of traditionalist, spiritualist, say off the beaten path literature, the sort of literature that doesn't get published any longer in mainstream publishing houses, and so needs a place to go in order to be heard. And we seek to present as well a platform for some of the ideas of some of the brightest people of our generation who simply don't get an opportunity to speak their mind because of the enclosing and, you know, rapidly encroaching political correctness of our time and all that that brings with it. I'm also a writer. I have several published books, including a novel and a piece of nonfiction. The novel is called Thorn Tree, and it's a contemporary retelling of the Faust legend. So I have a book called The New Prometheans, which I published via Arctos, and that's a book about our modern plight, our modern condition, and some of the things that we might do about it, or at least some of the ways that we might think about it. So that's very briefly me. I have a website, my name, www.johnbruceleonard.com, on which I publish some of my writing, including short stories and poetry, and my books can be accessed there as well.
Okay, I've just linked people to your website on DLive. It's already there on YouTube in the description. You said about ways that we could solve the problems of our time, but also the ways that we could look at it. Of course, it is always and this actually came up with the previous guest, that people expect that if you can diagnose a problem, you should also, hopefully, you'll also have some ideas for how to solve it. But I've found that that really is not the case. And it's to do with the mentalities. The type of person who is obsessed with how wrong things are is not the type of person usually who's good at coming up with solutions. That's a complete. It might well be that the solutions come from people who really don't like talking or thinking or hearing about problems very much, because they have a completely different nature where they want to think positively and constructively and so on. But in the meantime, it's up to people like us to alert them to the fact that there are very serious problems in Western civilization. I mean, how would you describe your own political or philosophical position, your political nature?
I think the best way that it could be summed up probably is just with the term traditionalist. It's obviously, by our contemporary spectrum of the left and the right, I would be leaning heavily towards the right, but I think that there are a lot of problems with that way of looking at things. I think there's actually some value to the word right itself. It carries a certain weight to it. It has a certain quality that I appreciate. But I do think that at the end of the day, the political spectrum that we have established is badly limited, and in fact is meant in a certain way to corral our thoughts and to limit us into very, very specific ways of seeing things that are very often not at all coherent with reality. But I would say that my political orientation definitely tends toward the preservation of traditional orders, which we have lost. And so, and to that extent, can be regarded as a kind of almost reactionary or even revolutionary in a certain sense political view, insofar as I think that the prime task that faces us today is finding some way of regaining all of the things that we have destroyed and rebuilding all of those things that we've spent a very, very long time, many centuries now, taking down brick by brick. And I think that the fruits, the consequences of our deconstruction of the past are becoming more and more evident to more and more people. It's very interesting what you say, Woz, about solutions and the people who can identify problems not being good at coming up with solutions. That seems to ring true in my experience. I think that in many cases, they can come up with a great many solutions, but they're very often not workable solutions, or there's something about them that just kind of doesn't quite fit with the facts of the case, and so you can't actually put them into practice, whereas it does seem to take a different kind of mentality or a different kind of mind to get out there and actually put things down and make things run in a certain way. But you know, I do believe that we're at a point now that we really do need to look for rather extreme solutions, because the extremity of our situation is really reaching a very fine point. And so I think that it might be worthwhile for us who do have this ability to see the problems of our present world and maybe set our minds a little bit more toward the seeking out of solutions and see if we can't round that bent off as well in our mentality.
Absolutely. Do you think that the left-right political spectrum is still relevant? It's still true?
It's relevant insofar as it describes a good proportion of the popular mindset. It has become so ingrained within our societies that it does, in fact, unfortunately, explicate and describe a certain array of viewpoints that one does commonly find amongst people today. I think that it is becoming less legitimate to the extent that people are becoming aware of the fact that we're living in times that are rather unique and rather, as I said before, extreme. And that forces people, I think, to think a little bit beyond the lines that they're given. But nonetheless, I think that, you know, its relevance has always been kind of artificial. Its relevance has kind of been an imposed relevance. It's been a way of excluding certain viewpoints from the political discourse altogether in order to obtain certain political ends. And primarily, I think that it was a tool of the revolutionary attitude of, say, the 1700s and 1800s in particular, toward the end of establishing these kinds of republican or democratic regimes and eliminating the old aristocratic and monarchical regimes. And to that extent, I think that it's interesting to find that when you're looking at a really radically aristocratic or monarchical position, or any kind of position which is rooted radically in a religious viewpoint, it's very difficult to locate it on the left-right political spectrum, because it tends to mix views that we would consider to be either of the left or of the right. And I think that this is all to design. I think that this thing was made in order to constrain our thinking, and it's been very effective at doing that. So it should not be relevant, but it is.
Yes, it's relevant for artificial and annoying and strategic reasons.
Right, exactly.
It's something that's meant to retard any progress, because you're supposed to be fully on the left or on the right, and you're supposed to hate those on the other side and find their ideas completely anathema. So you would never... I mean, this is something that I see with right-wingers who have to be against welfare.
Yes.
But how could you expect the poor today to live without welfare when corporations have a massive power? They can offshore their working class jobs to China. So what are you expecting the poor to do? I don't really understand. So therefore, how can you be against welfare? I don't really... That's obviously... There's more that could be said than that, but that's just one example.
It's a salient example, absolutely. Yeah, and it's the sort of thing that comes up very frequently. And I think that what's interesting about this left-right political spectrum is that, I mean, speaking of its relevance, it's become so apparent in our time the extent to which it can lead us, because we're, I mean, particularly in the United States, but I see this also in Europe, there's been this kind of a social breakdown which revolves around a number of very, very clear divisions that are already present in society. Some of these are racial, some of these are religious, but some of them are simply political. They just simply break along these really, really strange artificial lines that don't have any sense, really, and when you actually get down to think about political things. And the degree to which people have fallen into the camps that you talk about, Woz, and the degree to which there's almost been a hatred which has been building up of these two rather artificial camps for one another is really a striking sign of our times, I think. And it's unfortunately a very, very disturbing one, because in many cases, as you point out, I think that a great deal of common and sensible ground could be found amongst people who are purportedly of very different viewpoints if we were just able to think beyond these simple and often ridiculous terms.
Well, yes, and this is also relevant to the Brexit referendum.
Indeed.
I had a guest on, I think it was maybe last night when I made this point, which I've made before, that the Brexit referendum transcended political party lines. Yep. It didn't. You were voting on an issue, on an individual issue, not about any party. So it wasn't, your loyalty didn't come into question. And so then Labour voters voted in a way that was most un-Labour-like, which surprised and annoyed the Labour Party in a huge way. But also, of course, right-wingers suddenly found themselves with allies on the left and in the working class. And so it's like something that they hadn't expected. But I think that this is why I said that I think that if we're going to do democracy, then we should do it properly. And we shouldn't allow parties and party loyalty to get in the way.
Yes, yes. Do you think it's possible, democracy, a partyless democracy?
I don't know. That's the big problem here. See, I'm good at, I can come up with a half a solution at the start, but yes. I don't know whether it's. I definitely think that the party political the structure of having political parties is itself a problem. In this age, because it just creates ridiculous, unnecessary and unhelpful loyalties that don't actually help it. I mean, you've got like the big cliche example would be the working class left who vote Labour, and it's a party that systematically destroys them and their families. But they keep voting for it. That's completely insane.
Yes.
But at the same time, they can't vote for the Conservatives. I mean, obviously, this is a British-centric example. At the same time, they can't vote for the Conservatives because the Conservatives despise them as well and are bringing in big business and mass immigration. And so that's also against their interests.
Right, right.
So it's just a terrible situation. Ridiculous.
This is part of the reason I think that we've seen the rise of what has been termed populism in recent years, right? This is a kind of an attempt to return to a just sort of commonsensical view of political things and to return to kind of a base level, base ground of some of the policies and some of the ideas that should govern any healthy state. Now, obviously, there are all kinds of things mixed into it and it goes in all kinds of different directions. But I do think that's the basic thrust of it. And I think it's interesting to see how populism has been tied through a very, very carefully knit press campaign to the political right in particular. It's been tied to extreme rightism in particular, even though that's totally artificial and very clearly false when you look at what's actually being proposed by many of the populist leaders who are presently rising or have been rising in the past 4 years and in the world, past even longer than that. But certainly since the rise of Trump, since Brexit, since here in Italy, there have been a number of parties, including the Five Star Party and then the Northern League, which have embodied this sort of populist urge. And that's sort of, you know, it's really an indication that maybe there is a kind of way of sidestepping this political spectrum, and that might be one possible solution to the democratic conundrum that we touched on before, but it's unclear to what extent that's actually going to lead us anywhere.
Well, the problem, of course, is that the mainstream parties engage in this phony war with each other.
Yeah.
But that occupies the voters' attentions and their voting slips as well. So, because there aren't viable alternatives to vote for. On the matter of populism, wasn't there a party in Italy, or maybe it was even the government at one stage under Salvini? They were offering. Was it free? I think it was free land to people if they had three or more babies. Have I completely misremembered this?
It's entirely possible I just slipped by me, Woz, but I'm not familiar with anything like that. There were some policies that were put in place during that government which were favorable toward larger families, certainly, and that's a kind of mainstay of the Northern League in particular. The government wasn't actually Salvini's government. He was the interior minister. But yes. He was a very prominent figure. I mean, he was practically the only one that anyone talked about. Amusingly, the prime minister then was the same prime minister that we have now. He's just come more into the limelight now that he's able to just throw out decree after decree and decide, you know, kind of arbitrarily and whimsically his will on any given occasion for how to confront the new crisis and all of that. But yeah, it's when Salvini was in government for that very brief and beautiful period, there were a number of things that happened that were very favorable in a lot of different respects. And there were some policies of the sort that you're mentioning. Although, again, the one that you speak of, I would like to think that there was something like that. But if it happened, it somehow just completely flew past my radar.
Yeah, I was hoping that the DLive chat might have given me the details on that, but no one has said anything. I'm pretty sure I didn't dream that or anything. I'm pretty sure it is based on something real, that they were offering either grants to married couples who had three or more children, or it was actually small amounts of land.
Grants, I believe they did offer. Some kind of monetary support, at any rate. And that, I believe, did happen. I don't know the figures. I don't know how much was being offered. And I don't know exactly who was eligible. But I do recall something of that sort happening.
There's also Hungary has done a similar thing, and also Denmark did a similar thing with yes, but I'm sure it also happened in Italy as well. And someone's saying mortgage payments per child. I don't know, but I don't want to get stuck in the weeds with this, because it might well be that I've just made that up somehow.
And I hope it's still on the books. But
so do I. But I think the point is that mainstream parties, that there is this dreadful stranglehold that, I mean, I don't even know what term you would want to use, but the mainstream has a stranglehold on the big political parties in almost every country, such that they cannot, and they're peopled by individuals who would not want to stray from a very bland consensus, which is broadly pro-business, pro-LGBT, of course, pro-mass immigration, and anti-traditionalism, and anti-nativism, anti the people, ethnocentric, whatever you want to say. And it's backed up by massive big business, global capital. That really is the problem of our times, in a nutshell. Yes. Well, I mean, there's more to it than that. You could say the decline of religion.
It's a very deep rabbit hole, but yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but in structural terms, that's the problem, that the immediate problem that we're faced with. I think there are more deeper spiritual problems. I've talked about them at great length on my channel in the past, and I don't think that they've gone away. I don't want anyone to think that I'm just, sort of thinking that those things are not real. Of course, those problems are real. But I think that what we're faced with now, and it might well, it is that issue of the globalism having a stronghold over the political systems in every country. Now, it might well be that the solution to that is reliant on rejuvenation at the deeper level, at a spiritual level. And that is a scary prospect in a way, because that's going to take centuries. And this is what's so frightening. We might well be in a situation where, yes, there will be a recovery, but it will be too little too late. And by that time, we'll be outbred in our own homelands by other peoples who are not us. And so we'll not continue the European story. They'll continue their own story in Europe, but it won't be the story of the European people. Would you have anything to say about that?
Well, there's a lot to say about that. I think that you've clearly put your finger on the dilemma that we are confronting. And I think that so far as this question goes about where the rejuvenation has to begin, I do think that it would be foolhardy to hope that politics is going to resolve this without any kind of change at a much deeper level. And I agree with you, that is a very troubling prospect, because we are standing in a moment at which things are happening very rapidly. And a great many powers seem to be marshalling at present in order to see things happen even more rapidly still in the coming decade. So to that extent, we're standing upon a threshold that demands of us urgent and immediate action at a time in which we are absolutely unprepared for any kind of such action, because we've been, particularly in our generation, woes. I think that you and I are about the same age, and you know, we've grown up with just this kind of a culture, which is an anti-culture. It has done everything it can to cultivate in us the worst things that are part of our beings, and to set aside or suppress, or in many cases even demonize, the best things. To that extent, there's an enormous interior work which is demanded of each one of us. And again, we're just so totally unprepared for it. We're more unprepared for that kind of a battle than any generation preceding, and we have more need of it than most generations preceding us. That obviously paints a very dire picture. However, I do take at least some modicum of encouragement from the fact that the faster things go, and the more rapidly and the more evidently everything happens around us and everything begins to fall apart around us, there might be a chance that that gives us some possibility of breaking free with a greater degree of rapidity, insofar as we see the urgency, we see the fact that there really is something very deeply wrong, even if we don't understand it, even if we can't pinpoint it or look to the data and say this is what's really happening, even if we can't, you know, point out the news item or, you know, the real fact that's what's actually going on under the surface, even if it's just this sense that we have that things are deeply and badly wrong, that I think is already a start, particularly if we feel it deeply enough to actually move us into some kind of immediate activity. And that activity, again, I think it really does have to start within us, unfortunately. As you say,
I think you're absolutely right about that. And it's interesting what you say about people not knowing what it is that's wrong, but just feeling that there is something wrong. I think that's a very interesting observation, because almost everywhere I go, it just doesn't feel right.
Right.
You can just sense it in the air. You can look at that building, that person, that that lamppost, that car. There's a sense that everything is not quite as it should be, that there's right. A sort of perversity running in the air. The world does feel profoundly, but sometimes subtly, but always profoundly sick and unwell. I think that's a very interesting observation.
I take a bit of hope from the fact as well that I think if you and I were to have had this conversation, say, 4 years ago, we would have been taken by a great many people as being simply reactionary, simply, you know, sort of, I don't know, discontented youth, a bunch of malcontents who are just sort of, you know, spouting off on the internet because we're not happy with our lives or some nonsense like that. Nowadays, today, particularly in our year 2020, which is fast coming to a close, I think that resonates with a great many people. It's at least the kind of thing that would make a great many, even perfectly normal people, stop and think, well, actually, there's something to that. There really is something that I sense that's just, there's something not quite straight about the world. There's something off about things.
Yeah. And obviously, the spectacle of people wearing masks, some people have an instinctual reaction to that, a sort of revulsion. A lot of people don't, sadly. But also, I think that the disarray in our cultures and our political climates, I think that also awakens people to that there is something wrong. It's not just angry, and this is it's not just angry sort of losers on the internet who are saying this because they're angry losers. It's quite well-balanced people. It's all types of people who sense that there is just something wrong. And I think it's very interesting that an organization like the ADL, or especially in Britain, more so in the case of Hope Not Hate, what they have to do is pretend that, no, everything's actually fine.
Right.
The world is
exactly living in the best of all possible worlds, and it's getting better all the time.
Yeah. If people just stop giving into hate, then then everything will be fine. Everything's as it should. It's right that those jobs get offshore to China. It's right that your child is taught transgender. It's taught that they're transgender in school. It's right that your grandchild is not white. It's right that your society is meaningless. It's right that you're surrounded by a world you no longer recognize or understand or feel you have any stake in. It's right that there's no religion. It's right that the only religion is one that galvanizes foreign legions in your town. This is all just great. And why are you complaining? Why would you ever complain about this?
Because there's something deeply wrong with you, and you harbor a completely irrational hatred deep within the bowels of your soul that makes you act out in this way.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's really an amazing job that they have the burden of having to convince everyone that this is okay, that this is right, when blatantly it's not. And I think that, you know, if you think about some, I don't like constantly invoking the example of Rotherham, because it's
starts a hard one to avoid, though.
it is, and it does seem to sum everything up. But I don't want to sort of. But if you think of a northern industrial or ex industrial town like Rotherham, it used to have industry, it used to have religion, it used to have community, it used to have male and female. You know, men were men, women were women, and yes, there would be some who slipped through. That didn't work for it, like 1% or 0.1%. But everyone else, that was fine. It used to have marriage, and so on. But now it's got capital and disarray in every way, in social mores, morality, religion, spiritual level. It's got disarray everywhere. But at least there's this new box, this building that's just been put up for, and they'll be doing something for global capital there. I'm sorry to sound like a sort of student leftist talking about global capital, but this does seem to be the part of our curse on the right now, that we have to be against that, because it's obviously the source of it's the operating system of the dysfunction.
Neoliberalism. I mean, neoliberalism. I think that's another concept which should help us to completely transcend the left and right political spectrum, because we're speaking of something which is equally abhorrent to the true right and the true left, even within that very deliberately defined system. Right? This idea of neoliberalism being a kind of free-for-all, not even laissez-faire capitalist system, because that already is something a little bit better. But this is even something worse than that, because you're establishing these economies of scale which are completely undefeatable. You're concentrating quantities of money into very, very few hands, quantities of money such as can't even be imagined, that we can't even conceive of what that kind of money means. I imagine that even the people who have that much money in many cases can't really understand exactly what it is they're sitting on. And through this system of consolidating wealth into very, very few hands, giving over the power, the reins of power in our government and our media and our entertainment industry and our unfortunately, also in our churches, in many cases, in every aspect of our societies that, you know, used to be sovereign and authoritative aspects of our societies, they're now in the hands of this moneyed, very, very deeply interested class of individuals who either were born into enormities of wealth, which doesn't often conduce to virtue in our time, or else they are individuals such as were chosen for their ability to earn, which means that they were chosen for their ability to cast aside any kind of moral scruples in order to obtain these enormous sums of money. I mean, this is the situation in which we're living. And I think you're right, Woz. I think that if we do not indicate the flaws in this system and point to the deeply troubling and even deeply immoral aspect of this kind of wealth concentration, then we are simply throwing our duty out the window. I mean, it really does have to be said. And again, I think this is something that could unite us to many, many thinkers on the left who have seen, you know, the traditional kind of extreme left even, but, you know, certainly there's some certain Marxist thinkers even fall into this camp who see these problems with capital and are willing to speak out against it. And this can be found even in the academy today, even in universities, this sort of a thing can still be found. Although, again, there's a whole different set of problems. But at least there's this attempt to understand this neoliberal system in which we're living in and its problems. Of course, now we're entering into an entirely new epoch with the Great Reset and all of these fun novelties that await us. But
what that is interesting. Just first, I think you're right that this could unite us with a lot of thinkers on the left, which could in turn be the start of a new political position, which I think might well be necessary in order to mount a sufficient defense against or attack on globalism. So that's something that I think we should definitely be open to. I don't know if we have a choice at this point. But I do agree with you that this is a, you're right, that the kinds of money involved here are just gargantuan. They're incalculable for most people. You how could you conceive of having $500 billion or even $5 billion? I mean, that's, you know, this is astonishing, these amounts of money. I think it would be interesting to talk about the Great Reset then. What do you envisage that actually being, both in theory and in what you think it will actually unfold to be the reality of it?
I don't know, Woz. I say that quite frankly, because this past year has surprised me with the speed at which everything has transpired. And I anticipate, again, that the next decade is going to be very, very rocky. I think that we're probably going to see a great many changes. And I think many of these changes are going to be very, very fast. They're going to be pushed through with a kind of speed that it's difficult even to fathom. If we just think about how our lives were a year ago today, compared to how they are today, all of the changes that have happened in the mere course of a year, and in many cases in the mere course of a few months, we're looking at a very, very rapid agenda being rolled out before our very eyes. And so it's difficult to say exactly what is intended with the Great Reset. Exactly. I've read the book by this man, Klaus Schwab, COVID-19, The Great Reset, COVID-19. And it's very hard in many cases to decipher what it is these people want underneath the kind of economic jargon and the sort of coded language that they use. Excuse me. I think that one of the pivotal points that they're going to be focusing on is digital currency. I anticipate that being a very, very central question here, because it's only through digital currency that they can rework our economies. They can transform our societies and our economies, as they like to say. The system that we have right now in place, the monetary system that we have right now in place, is not sustainable. It's probably been unsustainable now for some decades, but it's getting to the point where it really cannot even be maintained without interfering at every level continuously through the injection of enormous sums of money. I mean, but going back to these gargantuan sums of money that you were talking about. So I don't think that can be perpetuated much longer. Moreover, they've reached a point which I think actually is very favorable to them in a lot of ways, unfortunately, at which in the next few months, there's going to be an enormous amount of economic devastation, the fallout from this disaster of 2020. And there are going to be a lot of people who are in bad need of financial aid. And that's the sort of thing that cannot be given through fiat currency indefinitely without leading to the ruin of the economy. No matter how much you juggle these things around and send your debt to China, it doesn't matter. One day or another, it's going to catch up to you. Digital currency is pivotal, then. They need to be able to restructure the economy to such a radical extent that they can actually affect things like universal basic income, which is unfortunately just another way of speaking about a new kind of monetary slavery. There used to be debt slavery. Now there's going to be a new kind of monetary slavery, which is almost going to be a kind of credit slavery, if you will. So I think that those are two points that are really going to be hit hard. Obviously, there's the environmental question. They're going to be speaking about that. This has been wrapped into the whole COVID thing. And these new means of automated services and automated production lines and things like that all has to be taken into account as well. But none of this is feasible if they don't get a couple of things in place first. 5G is obviously among these. They have to have some kind of infrastructure in place which will permit this reworking of the workforce and, you know, forcing people to work from home and things like that, and breaking up societal and, you know, normal societal interactions. So all of those things are going to be touched upon. But I really think the digital currency is right at the root of this. I think that that's one of the major issues that's going to come up, and I think they're probably going to push that pretty hard.
So that would relate to the going cashless, right, in exactly, meat space, as it were. Would it also relate to cryptocurrency? And do you, are you aware of the Facebook's own cryptocurrency? Yes.
I don't know what to think of that. I mean, I think that there are a number of cryptocurrencies that are out right now that seem to be possible players in what's coming. It might be that they enact a system of in a multi-layered cryptocurrencies where there are different cryptocurrencies for different parts of the economy. But one way or another, the moment that our transactions become digitally markable, digitally you know, documentable event, at that point, you know, I really think the game is pretty much lost at that point. I don't see how we could possibly break free once that's been instated. I think that that marks a point of no return. I do not see how it would be possible after the instatement of a global digital currency of any kind, even if it's a, you know, using multiple digital currencies, multiple cryptocurrencies. I think at that point we've really lost. I would not know how to break free at that point. We're talking about a degree of slavery which is so insidious and so universal and so ubiquitous that the only thing that one could do is to attempt to reestablish informal markets, black markets and things like that, where you're just, you know, exchanging goods amongst friends, or maybe trying to form some kind of currency yourselves and things like that. That needs to be done, incidentally. I highly encourage that kind of a thing. But I think that once they have that kind of control over people, once they have that kind of visibility, that there's that sort of transparency even in your account, and they know exactly what you're buying and exactly who you're paying to do exactly what, they have the ability to cut off your funds at any moment for any reason under the sun, even completely arbitrary ones. We know very well what that means when we, you know, we who are subject to these continual threats of deplatforming and things of that sort. I mean, deplatforming is bad enough when we're talking about, say, YouTube. Imagine deplatforming when we're talking about your bank account. I mean, it's really a very, very dire thing that we're facing here. And the problem is that right now our economies are going to be in such bad shape that it's going to be very, very easy for them to push something like that through. And this gets back to what we were talking about before, was that there really is a need, a desperate need right now for us to attempt to ground ourselves in a sort of reality in our real lives, in order to be able to confront these things when they happen, in order to establish some kind of a basis in our lives, to what extent we're able to be able to stand outside of these systems, the more and more that they attempt to encroach into our personal existences. I think that that's really key right now. This takes all different kinds of forms, from trying to maintain some kind of food independence, from trying to maintain some kind of monetary independence, again, working, you know, with informal markets, bartering, you know, using informal currencies, all things along these lines. Certainly, obviously, having conversations with as many people as one can about this sort of thing and trying to make people aware of the consequences of the world that is coming. But it's very difficult. It's very difficult to explain to someone why it would be such a bad thing to have a cashless society when there are so many conveniences that could come from it, and so many.
Well, where do you stand on the crypto question then? Presumably, you see that as a well. What do you think?
Well, I would not. I don't know enough about it to comment specifically on, you know, any specific cryptocurrencies. I don't own any cryptocurrencies. I did do some research into this and decided that I wanted to have nothing to do with any of it, even though I do think it's entirely, I think it's obvious that there are certain cryptocurrencies that have a good basis. They're clearly put together by well-intentioned people, and they do seem to have some kind of integrity to them, even on the level of, say, you know, their digital structure and things like that. But it just seems to me that there's something, unfortunately. Well, first of all, I don't think that it's going to be those cryptocurrencies that are chosen to be the global players in any kind of global banking scheme. It just wouldn't. I mean, they're going to make their own kind of cryptocurrency, or they're going to choose cryptocurrencies, already existing cryptocurrencies, that are suitable to their desires and to their schemes. So I don't place any great hope in those. I think that it's not impossible to imagine a world in which that sort of thing were just illegalized. And I don't know. I mean, all of this comes down as well to the extent to which the internet can be controlled and our, you know, digital means of communication can be controlled. There will always be a sort of realm there that will be a kind of frontier world, sort of wild west of the digital. And there will always be space there for a degree of freedom. But I think that that can be cordoned off very effectively. And I think that we've seen this, we're going to see more of it with the social media, with centers like YouTube. And unfortunately, it's not particularly hard to establish a kind of base core of conventional, sort of a conventional digital realm in which most people circulate. And then there's that hinterland where very few people go. And I think that we'll probably see a more extreme break between those two. I have this kind of inherent skepticism and almost a suspicion woes about most of our technology. To me, there's even something a little bit odd about what we're doing here, although, you know, I'm very much enjoying this conversation. And I'm very happy to be making contact with you. But, you know, it would just be better for me if we were sitting at a table and we could, you know, speak face to face and I could look you in the eye, which is something you can't do in these things and things like that, you know. But there's something curiously fragmented about our entire digital existence. And so to that extent, I'm wary of things like cryptocurrencies. I prefer things that I can get my hands on, and I just don't, I have this sort of, I don't know, implicit Luddism inside of me or something like that, but I just
but it is understandable though, because it is something new and it's something baffling to a lot of people. You might well be right that I think you are right that they will want to go to digital currency, and because that's trackable, or they can make it trackable 100%. So, but then on the other hand, there could always be currencies that are exempt from that, that aren't trackable. I think that Monero is private, completely private, so that cannot be tracked, as far as I know. So, the other part of it though is, if this is going to be something that's big in the future, that, and money does to some extent equal power, then we dissidents should be on board with it in order to maximize our power share in the future. What would you say about that?
I see the power of the argument. I think that there is, and it's walking a very, very thin line. Any kind of participation in the decadence of our time obviously carries with it the risk that we participate at too deep of a level. And I very much feel that with technological use in particular. I think that, for example, it is impossible today to even hope to break the power of the system that is growing around us without having recourse to the social media, without having recourse to videos like this one, without having recourse to the internet and the plethora of means that it gives to our that puts at our disposal for this sort of a thing. But the temptation then is to throw ourselves into it and to live in it, to immerse ourselves in it and to become in a certain kind of way, you know, this sort of modern digitized being that just lives on the computer and speaks to people who are far away and doesn't really have any, you know.
Yeah, it's a depressing matter because it sort of elucidates that, yes, okay, you might have currency in the future, but it might just be currency that you can use to buy, you know, digital goods, which keep you entertained in the pod. You know, that's I think we're sort of edging towards acknowledging that it's this scary future. And I wish I could tell people, here's the solution, here's what you should do. But I don't have a solution for this.
And no, I mean,
I think anyone who does is probably pretending, lying.
I agree with you. Yeah, exactly. I mean, my quandary has always been that I have this this kind of a tendency to just want to break free of all of it and live away from it. But, you know, if you do that, you're not going to affect any kind of change. You're not going to make contact with people who actually want to change. You won't, you'll miss out on a whole, you know, on conversations like this one, from which you can learn so much and real human contacts and things like that. And so it really does become this, this kind of a real catch 22, and it's difficult to know how to break that. As far as, you know, the digital currency question goes in particular, though, I don't doubt that there are digital currencies that really are reliable, that really are safe, that really are private, that are secure in that sense. I just think that they're going to be regulated to such an extent that they won't matter, or more probably still, even if they're allowed in some kind of delimited sector of our economies, we're going to be facing a situation in which they won't be able to purchase anything save through a number of very specific suppliers. I mean, what exactly are you going to buy even with a very, very valid cryptocurrency when all products are brought to your home via a number of very, very small number of companies by drones, and everything's dropped off at your front door? I mean, these are the things they're proposing right now. You're not even going to be buying.
Well, it's already happening. It's already happening. It's already, yeah. And I heard that in, I think it was Milton Keynes, which is a town in Britain that has apparently quite a grid-like structure. They're piloting, because of that grid-like structure, they're piloting robots that deliver things. Right. So it's literally, I don't know whether a human would ever be involved at any stage, right, in this, exactly, commercial transaction.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing. And this is, you know, I keep saying this, I'm sorry to keep hammering away at this, but it does seem to me that we're heading, or we have already arrived at the cyberpunk future that was predicted in the 80s, where a small number of huge corporations basically own and control everything, and they're more powerful than the governments, and there's no way to live your life without interacting with these corporations.
dead on. That's the world we're already living in, it, as you point out. We're going to be living still more in it in the coming years if something doesn't change very, very soon. Yeah, well, I mean, I just read the news today, actually, just, you know, speaking of this drone situation, that apparently it's now possible in the United States to fly drones over people's head, even without their permission, and at night. This is something that's just happened. I was just reading the news a couple of hours ago, if I read it correctly. I was just skimming. But I mean, so, I mean, just another sign of where we're going.
It's now legal to, what did you say?
It's legal to fly drones over people's heads, even without their permission now. You know, it's legal by the official regulations of the FAA in the United States. And it's also legal to fly them at night, I think, throughout the national territory, if I understand that correctly. I mean, everyone should look into this. I did not read this carefully. But anyway, it's another step in that direction.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really an amazing situation. One ray of hope is that apparently the European Union, and this is ironic because of Brexit, but apparently the EU is going to be dominated by nationalist parties in about 5 years from now. Apparently, this was a prediction that I saw based on current trends. Each European country is getting more nationalistic, but especially when it comes to voting for their EU politicians, for their MEPs. Because within each European country, obviously the party loyalty stuff comes in.
Right.
But when it comes to voting for your MEP, it's a different matter.
And apparently, very few people vote for them. Very few people vote for their MEP.
Yeah, no one. Yeah, exactly. But what that means is that it's more people who are politically motivated. Exactly. So the undecided middle ground man in the Clapham omnibus type voter doesn't really come into it with the EU Parliament.
Right.
It's the people on the extremes. So apparently, the EU is going to be pretty nationalistic in 5 years from now.
One can hope.
Very ironic for an organization that does seem to be inherently globalistic. But obviously, if that did happen, that would have all sorts of repercussions. Unless the EU just showed its hand and admitted that we really don't care what goes on in the EU Parliament.
Exactly.
It's just a talking shop. But it does seem that there is bound to be, because I don't want to leave people on a black pill, it does seem to be that there is inevitably going to be rebellion against all of this in a massive way, because it is such an unnatural situation that we're living in, and basically it does mean a form of slavery for every one of us. If this keeps going, and if it reaches a certain critical momentum or technical momentum, would you have anything to say on that matter?
I agree with you entirely, Woz. I mean, as I said earlier, I think that one of the few narrow, slender, but nonetheless solid bases that we have for hope in all of this is the fact that if things continue at this pace, we will certainly see some kind of a backlash. I mean, we've seen some degree of backlash even in this past year, I think, that probably would not have been possible had there not been such severe and restrictive measures being put in place by national governments across the world. So that's an indication of the sort of thing that I think we really need to be hoping for, and we really need to be pushing. Because without that, I don't think that we're going to be able to save ourselves. There is reason to think that that sort of a thing could occur. I think that, you know, again, populism is another indication of that. This fact that, there has been a kind of, say, revolt in the electoral level of our populaces to a great many measures that have been put in place, particularly so far as immigration is concerned, and these sorts of really extreme programs of, you know, cultural manipulation that have to do with, you know, transgenderism and all of that. So that does give us some promising signs. And I think that it's difficult to say where things are going to go. And it depends, I think, as well on human freedom, which I do think exists. I don't think that we're merely mannequins being pulled about by the strings of some kind of infernal puppet master, although we can allow ourselves to be that if we so choose. But there is some kernel of human freedom in all of this, and that's what makes history unpredictable, and it makes history unsusceptible to any kind of scientific investigation. So that does give some ground for hope. It does give us some space for hope. But I think that very much depends on our actions. And I think that very much depends on our actions as well, and perhaps above all, with the people who are around us in our lives. Videos like this, of course, have their effect. They have a great deal of power. But very often, I think more and more we're going to see this. Videos like this received attention from people who, in many respects, already agree. There are these communities that are formed. That's what they're called nowadays, right? These internet communities. And I think that's actually kind of a misnomer, because we're speaking of voluntary associations, almost, of people of like mind, which is a wonderful thing. But it can't stop there. There is much more power, I think, in many cases, in sitting down with somebody in real life, you know, in a sane and calm and reasonable way. You know, obviously I'm not talking about going out and finding some kind of shrill purple haired, you know, college student who's absolutely dead set on eliminating the patriarchy or something like that. But people that we know, people who are reasonable, people who will listen to us, sitting down with them and speaking to them, not with anger, not with rage, not with, you know, even this feeling of, impending disaster, but simply talking things through as I think once upon a time human beings probably did. It's just become very, very desperate now, I think, that we do this, that we relearn the art of speaking to one another about important topics, even when we disagree, particularly when we disagree. That has to happen offline. It can't happen here. I mean, a video like this, if it's showed to certain people, they'll just shut down. But if you have a conversation with them, you might be able to get somewhere. So I think that...
Oh, that's definitely true. And I would encourage people to speak to those, you know, people you meet in real life.
Yeah.
And also, I would, just on that matter, I would encourage people not to do this with their relatives. Because do it with other people, but not with your relatives, because it's more important that you remain on good terms with your relatives. You don't need your relatives to share your political views, right? That's a kind of a misconception that a lot of people develop as well. I've got to get my brother on board. I've got to get my mother on board. You actually don't. It's more important that you're on good terms with them. So don't let politics get in the way there.
Yes.
But with other people that you meet in real life, I think you should be having these conversations, because it's your duty, apart from anything else. I mean, do you believe in civil in the West or not? Do you want this to survive or not? Now, I don't mean Western civilization, by the way, because that might it might well be time for this to die and be replaced with something else. I'm not going to be overly attached to the expression the Western civilization. However, you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Do you want us to be globalist slaves plugged, you know, in the pod and all that, or do you want us to be, you know, barbarians in living under some kind of awful foreign theocracy, or do you want a continuation of sanity? And if you do want a continuation of sanity, as I do, then it is imperative and incumbent upon you to make other people aware of this and of the situation and talk it through with them and listen to what they have to say as well.
I would add, I mean, I think that you're right on with that, but the remarks about what you say to your family members, that I agree entirely with that. I think that one thing we really have to be wary of, and this is very tricky, but we really have to be wary of the fact that we are living in a society in which there are powerful interests that are dead set on tearing apart society, our society, by encouraging the ruptures and the natural sort of cracks that have already emerged on the face of the porcelain, and by expanding these things. It's very, very easy to fall into that kind of a party mindset, even when you're not a fan of a particular party. And you have that idea of, you know, this is something that everybody has to believe, and I'm going to go out and I'm going to proselytize. I'm not talking about religion here, even though I've used obviously religiously loaded expressions. I think religion is another question altogether, and it does behoove a man to be very, very serious and very diligent about his religious beliefs. But in terms of what we think is happening on the political and social scale, in terms of things that I think we can really find some common ground with a great many individuals in our lives, it can't be turned into a war. If it's turned into a war with the people who are around us, a purposeless war, a war just for the sake of battling, a war just for the sake of being right, then we're falling into the hands of the people who are effecting these changes in our societies, because there is no one who is going to benefit from the unraveling of our cultural fabric, if not them. And they've been very, very good at establishing these kinds of conflicts between us. And I think that to the extent that we are able, without infringing on our principles, we need to fight back against that, precisely by not standing up as sort of, you know, the outraged members of some kind of angry chorus, but rather really attempting diligently to care for the soul of our neighbor, because, you know, in a certain sense, we're all going to stand or we're all going to fall together. I mean, obviously that's not a universally intended expression, but we really do need to find some kind of solidarity in all of this. And I think that it's very important that we attempt to establish a basic kind of human contact that is not merely confrontational, because that's only going to make matters worse. But it's very difficult because we're talking about issues that have been given this kind of this weight or this
an incendiary reputation. So it is, and especially across political lines,
right,
it's very difficult. But I think we do need to, as you say, interact with other. I mean, hopefully next year's millennial, I'll have more people, a greater variety still of people from, you know, the left and the center and so on. I would like that.
Yeah.
I think that would be a good development. That's definitely what I want to do. And I it's not because I necessarily disagree with anything that I've said in the past. I don't think I do really. I just want to learn about and interact with other types of people. I think it's what we ultimately want is a return. I said a continuation of sanity. Someone else said a return to sanity.
That's probably the more appropriate way of putting it.
Yeah. I think that's right. And I think for that, you have to start with yourself. As you said at the beginning, this is something that each individual has to work on himself or herself. And would you have anything, before we finish, would you have any words to say on that matter?
Well, I increasingly think that the real root of all of this, particularly so far as any kind of personal development goes, really does have to come down to religion. And I use that word very advisedly. I don't mean a mere spirituality, although I think that's definitely a part of it. But I think that spirituality has the danger of devolving into an extremely personalized kind of reinforcement of what one already believes. It has that danger because one is not putting oneself under the guidance of any kind of tradition, any kind of authority, any kind of external wisdom. Whereas religion does have the ability to set us under the guidance of what one at least could hope is a greater wisdom than our own. I say this, of course, at an historical moment, which is very, very tried in this regard. I think that I don't even need to comment on the disastrous decomposition that we've seen in our religions, our Western religions in late years. And I think that this, again, is just another facet of what we've been talking about, was this kind of campaign, which is this dedicated campaign, which has been waged against the entirety of the West and all of its underpinnings. And one of its central underpinnings has always been a religious one, and primarily a Christian one in the West of the last 2,000 years. In consequence of that, we are at a time in which it is not easy to find a religious place to rest. And this is something that I struggle with personally, but I think it's something that we all have to struggle with personally. I cannot pretend to stand here and recommend any particular religion to anyone because it's not something that I've sorted out for myself. But I think that this is a question that if we are not taking seriously to the point that it is capable of changing our lives, then I think that we're probably not. We haven't gone far enough. I think that there will be no escape from any of this if it's not on the basis of something that extends deep into the past and deep into our spiritual natures. And I think that the only thing that's capable of doing that is religious tradition. So I would add that in as a fundamental component of all of this, which I think needs to be touched upon. I also wanted to mention a project that I've recently started up with a good friend of mine, Jared George. It's called Learning in Public, and the videos are available on YouTube. And it's a different kind of attempt at reclaiming some of this digital ground, which I think is fast being lost to the vices of our day. It's something that's very easy. It happens very easily. Unfortunately, we live in a time that really makes the most of all of our vices and all of our weaknesses and does whatever it can to exploit those in us. So I think that we have to attempt to counter that by in some way redeeming these tools that have been given us. It's not an easy thing to do. And as I pointed out before, it's something that, you know, it's not easy to do in particular without falling into the trap of actually, you know, becoming a kind of technologized human being. It tends toward transhumanism and all of that. And that's a topic for an entirely different conversation. But when you were talking about digital currency woes and some of the promise that's involved in that, that might well be another area in which this sort of thing can be affected. Jared George and I have begun this series of videos in which we're attempting to establish a kind of conversational tone. We're talking about a great many different topics. It's not all of it political. It's not all about one thing or another. It's about really anything that crosses our mind. In many cases, we just sit down and have a conversation about, you know, and we just let the conversation guide us. And it's an attempt, among other things, to carve out a space in this digital world for a different kind of tempo, a different kind of rhythm, a different kind of way of approaching ideas. It's something that we're, you know, working through as we go. And so it's sort of a project, a living project, if you will. But again, it's called Learning in Public. It's me, John Bruce Leonard, and Jared George. And it's been on the air now for a number of months. We tend to record one every week or 2 weeks. And so I encourage anyone to come check it out who might just be interested in conversing about things. But I bring that up primarily because I think that that's another aspect of it's something that we can do with consciousness, and it's something that we can do day to day, and that's be very, very aware of this technological world that we're living in, the digital world that we're living in, the effects that it has on us, and where we want to draw the line with all of that. I, for example, do not have a smartphone, and I refuse to get one. I will continue to refuse to get one until it becomes just absolutely practically impossible for reasons that are completely beyond my control. I might even press past that point. But at any rate, I think that it's important for us all to establish a line. That's what I'd like to say. Smartphone doesn't have to be the line. That's my line. I think it's a good one. But I think that all of us have to decide what we're willing to allow into our lives as far as this digital world goes and what we're not. And we have to be aware of the fact that these are not just neutral tools that we're working with. These are deliberately structured things, or in many cases, they're just chaotic and amorphous ones like the internet. But in cases like the smartphone, in cases like the social media, these things have been structured consciously with the aim of transforming us all into addicts, tapping into those parts of our psychology which are most dedicated to rage and to very bestial reactions to things, because that's what keeps us coming back. They really tap into our vices in many ways, and we've got to be aware of that. And we've got, in each of our lives, we have to be conscious of that. We've got to draw a line, because it's going to get much more extreme in very, very short order. So I think that's another important part of all of this.
Yeah, I do think that each one of us should try to establish a situation that can be sustained and that can sustain us.
Yes.
Because I do think this, the next, as I've said before, I think the next 5 to 10 years are going to be very trying for a lot of people. So I would say aim for sustainability just now, and try to strengthen your position as much as you can. I mean, you need to be thinking, like we used to encourage young people to think in their 20s, build yourself up now, because you're going to need it later on. I think that's the attitude that we should be encouraging in people, not just young people, but middle-aged people as well, right now, because it's not going to be easy the next decade or so.
For all of us who have a bent for it, not all of us do, but I think that the countryside is definitely something to consider strongly, and farming, or at least cultivating a garden, something of the sort, some small livestock situation.
Yeah, that's something I'm looking into myself, actually.
I highly recommend it.
All right. Okay, well, excellent. This has been a very nice conversation, and I hope other people have enjoyed it. So, okay, excellent. We'll end it there. I'll be back in an hour, hopefully, with Luke Smith, although I'm not sure because he isn't answering the email, but I hope that he's going to appear. In the meantime, John Bruce Leonard, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2020.
It's been my pleasure, Woz. Thanks so much for having me. I'll look forward to speaking to you again.
Okay, thank you very much. And I'll see the rest of you, hopefully, in about an hour from now. Bye-bye.